Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Signs have been increasing for weeks that President Trump is headed toward pulling out of the Paris Agreement on climate change. The president has talked about the accords harming the economy, stifling job creation, and affecting Appalachia and the West, where some of Trump's strongest supporters live. That approach is also consistent with the president's America First theme. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talked with Republican U.S. Representative Rodney Davis about the issue. Congressman Davis says abandoning the Paris Agreement is not necessarily a bad thing.
That doesn't mean that the United States can't continue to lead on addressing emissions and emissions output in our country and help be a leader so that we can work with other countries who don't invest in emission control standards like we do here in this country and like we have over the last 25 to 30 years to reduce our footprint by a substantial margin.
If we're not part of the conversation, though, globally, and we're just going unilaterally, how is that leading?
Well, America is always part of the conversation, whether or not they're part of a structured agreement or not, because America's economic output and just economic engine will ensure that we're going to be part of the debate. And the focus has to be, too, on what America's done right over the last few decades, whereas other countries, close by to the United States, have not invested in emissions infrastructure like we have. And America needs to continue to lead, and we will, regardless of whether or not we're in a multilateral agreement that research has shown we would fall 35% short of our goals, even if implementing 100% of what the Obama administration wanted us to do.
What is the downside of staying in the agreement for us?
Well, I'm not going to debate an upside or a downside because it's not my decision. But what I can tell you is, as part of the Climate Solutions Caucus, somebody who believes in an all-of-the-above energy approach, I'm going to continue to tout technologies that are going to allow us to grow economically, which includes coal and also baseload generating facilities, and then also how we increase our amount of renewable energy as part of our overall portfolio. But we have to realize the facts are we cannot run America's manufacturing sector on renewable energy alone. We have to have baseload generating facilities. I have 3 coal-fired power plants in my district. I have a nuclear facility that has zero emissions that doesn't get any credit like renewables do for the zero emissions that energy output output is. And remember, the baseload generating facilities like those 4 plants are the ones that give us access to cheap power. They're the ones that allow large manufacturing facilities like the old Diamond Star plant to operate and be affordable to operate. Those are the facilities that we have as part of our portfolio, or the costs just to turn the lights on are going to go up for every single senior on fixed income.
Some economists, though, think that over the longer term, coal is not going to benefit all that much, even if we pull out, because natural gas and other forms are, over the long term, more economically beneficial.
Well, I would like those economists to go talk to the IBEW workers that work at our coal-fired power plants in the 13th District and tell them how they're going to economically benefit when their job no longer exists right here in central Illinois. And when we take those baseload facilities off, if companies aren't willing to invest in retrofitting for natural gas, then those jobs are going to go away and that power on the grid is going to go away and the prices are going to go up. And also, there's a lot of talk about converting old facilities to natural gas facilities. The question I always ask somebody who advocates for a complete elimination of coal and moving, and nuclear in many cases, and moving just to natural gas, if they support fracking or not. Because without fracking technology, we don't have access to affordable natural gas. So we're going to have that debate before we risk putting America's energy capacity on one source that countries like Germany have already done. And now Germany, because of decisions made years ago, have seen their their cost for utility rates skyrocket way beyond what was estimated, and Vladimir Putin has become somewhat of a natural gas sugar daddy for the country of Germany. That's not a position I want the United States to ever be in. That's why we need a balanced, all-of-the-above approach that includes coal, that includes natural gas, and includes nuclear.
You had talked about the U.S. continuing to lead even if we exit from the Paris Accords. One of the counter arguments being put out there is that it makes it easier for other countries to leave the Paris Accords who maybe do need the structure of the Accords to reduce their emissions.
Well, I've never been one to think that multilateral accords are necessary to make progress on a global scale. I would urge anyone who has concerns about emissions and emission controls to travel just 90 miles off our coast to the country of Cuba. It's 90 miles away from the United States, and the lack of investment in infrastructure because of the structure of government in the country of Cuba leads to zero emissions controls. Go look at the smokestack that is burning in the Bay of Havana that's burning straight oil. Let's invest time and energy to make sure that we have countries that don't have the capacity to invest in emission controls. Let's help them do so also, because the United States does not get enough credit for what we've done to protect our environment unilaterally over the last 25 to 30 years. Charlie, we've grown up in a lifetime where we saw rivers catch on fire because of pollution. That doesn't happen anymore. We've made tremendous progress in this country, and let's make sure we take some of the progress that we've made to some other countries like Cuba and help them too.
U.S. Representative Rodney Davis speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlinker in Davis's office in Uptown Normal. Outside the office, protesters continued to hold signs accusing Davis of voting against the public interest on health care and the environment. GLT and NPR will bring you President Trump's announcement this afternoon at 2 p.m. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And you're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Illinois General Assembly has ended its annual legislative session without agreeing on a budget. Top Democrats and Republicans blamed each other. As IPR's Brian Mackey reports, state government's long, slow financial crisis will accelerate.
For more than 2 years, the main political divide in Springfield has been between Democrats and Republicans. But this year's budget failure exposed an additional set of fault lines among Democrats. The Senate spent much of the past 5 months in bipartisan negotiations, attempting to strike a grand bargain that both satisfied Governor Bruce Rauner's economic agenda and adequately funded Illinois government. But when those talks broke down, Senate Democrats decided to go it mostly alone, passing the bills they say they negotiated with Rauner and the Republicans. The grand bargain became petite, but it did include a series of tax hikes, and that seems to have overwhelmed the House Democrats.
So, ladies and gentlemen, our House Democratic caucus just concluded.
Representative Greg Harris is a Democrat from Chicago.
It is our decision that more work needs to be done on our budget proposal, so we will not be voting today.
Harris says his colleagues had concerns. He blamed their failure to vote on a budget on Rauner and the governor's intervention in grand bargain negotiations.
A lot of folks have watched what has happened in the Senate, where they thought they had reached an agreement at the end of that agreement, you know, they found out the governor was pulling votes off the bill and then attacking the very people who had worked on the compromise for voting for things that he had previously supported.
So instead of passing a budget by the usual May 31st deadline, Harris says House Democrats will convene a series of hearings in June. Rauner was not amused.
Please, members of the General Assembly in the majority, do not travel around the state holding sham hearings about a balanced budget.
Rauner blamed Democrats for his failure to get his budget proposal enacted and for wrecking the grand bargain.
Speaker Madigan and the House Democrats sent a lot of special interest groups, a lot of lobbyists over, pressured the Senate Democrats very harshly, and killed the deal. They gave up at the end, and the grand bargain failed.
Rauner, however, did the same thing to Republicans, as Democratic Senate President John Cullerton pointed out.
He hijacked the grand bargain. He came in the middle of the process, told the Republicans to vote no.
Cullerton says the same thing happened in the House.
Republicans didn't vote for anything, and with some exceptions, and as a result, we don't have a budget.
Meanwhile, the government functions most pinched by the lack of a budget will continue to be squeezed. Programs for vulnerable residents will continue to shut down. State universities will continue laying off staff. And schools will be left to wonder whether they'll have enough money to open their doors next August. Everything about this might sound familiar. It's pretty much the same story we've been telling about Illinois government for 2 years. But there is at least one difference this year. Rank-and-file legislators are increasingly frustrated with the constant political attacks by the leaders, parties, and outside groups. And they're beginning to say so in public.
I understand that is happening outside of this building, but we have got to stay focused on the goal.
Representative Sarah Wojcicki-Jimenez is a Republican from Springfield. Asked about Governor Rauner's constant attacks on Speaker Madigan, she says it's not helpful.
It would not be my approach. You know, now is the time, through today and through the end of next month, for us to build bridges and not burn them.
Wojcicki-Jimenez is not alone in that sentiment, yet Democrats and Republicans don't even agree on just what in Illinois needs fixing. And if the parties don't agree on the question, it's hard to see how they'll come to terms on an answer. I'm Brian Mackey.
And I'm Mike McCurdy at Sound Ideas. There's another casualty of the Illinois budget impasse. For the past 20 years, children and teens who suffer emotional difficulties due to abuse or neglect have found a home at the Baby Folds Residential Care Center. But at the end of this month, the residential facility in Normal is closing its doors. Baby Fold officials say the state has not increased the fees it pays for this kind of residential care in more than 10 years. The agency itself has paid out $1.6 million over the past 2 years to make up for the funding shortfall. The Baby Fold will continue to operate its Hammett School program for special needs students, its adoption and foster care program, and offer other services to families. Amy Beam, the Baby Fold's vice president for development, tells GLT's Judy Valente the state is moving away from residential care programs, but it's unclear what will replace them.
Over the last couple of years, there has been pressing and mounting challenges, and we did in 2015 decide to reduce that particular program from 28 beds to 14, thinking that could mitigate some of the problems, but the challenges seem to not cease with the state of the state. And some of the children that are there, in fact, are there and paid for by our state funding, and that is really but our funder is not required to make payments with the impasse. And so it's really been a challenging situation for us.
You say that the state is moving away from residential care. Moving away to what?
Well, that's the great question. Because we feel like this is a necessary service, but there isn't anything in place. And I think that they're moving away from it because it is a very high cost type of care. The children, let me just explain, that are in the residential treatment center have complex emotional and mental health issues that require around-the-clock, 24-hour care. And this isn't something that, say, a family could typically handle at home, even a loving and willing adoptive family. It is something that we specialize in, and we feel that these children need this type of service. But the funding isn't there. DCFS hasn't increased the rates that they're paying us for these services in about 10 years. And we've had countless conversations over this decade-long battle about the consequences of not increasing those rates. And it seems to have fallen on deaf ears. And there pretty much isn't any stone that our experts at the Baby Fold have left unturned to try to save this program. But there comes a point where We just can't support it anymore. Just over the course of the last 24 months, we've had to subsidize the program to the tune of $1.6 million.
I was going to ask you how much you're owed. So would that be what the state owes you?
Well, that's just for that particular program. Actually, right now, I just checked before I came over to talk with you, and we're currently owed $911,000. But the total amount of the subsidy that we've had to provide just for this one program at the Baby Fold has been $1.6 million.
What will happen to the residents of the program, of the center, now that they can't stay there any longer?
Mm-hmm. Well, right now it's an all-hands-on-deck, across-agency effort to find new placements for these children. We've already had some success with reuniting one child with family members, and we're going to try to find other similar facilities to ours, which mostly exist up north, wherever possible. And that is the top priority right now for all of the experts at our agency. We're working very closely with DCFS and with the families wherever possible.
But if the state is moving away from residential facilities, wouldn't their placement in centers even in the north of Illinois be in jeopardy as well?
I believe that's a fair statement, and we're just hoping that DCFS, other state entities, see the light. What is the next step? If this is something that they're not going to continue to support, what will they support? So for these 14 children, we feel good about the fact that we can use all of our resources and cash in every favor to try to get them into good places. But the future, just like the future of the state, is uncertain. And we would like some solutions to be brought forth.
If you're owed $900,000 mm-hmm. from the state, roughly $911,000
across all programs,
$11,000, and how do you pay people's salaries, and how do you keep the programs going?
Well, that's a good question. The Baby Fold has always been strong and stable. We have a 115-year history of being conservative with the gifts that were given to us, and we do have some reserves. And where we think there is a future for a program, we can definitely weather rocky times. But there comes to a point where we have fiscal responsibility to all of the other programs that we have, because the Residential Treatment Center, for example, is one of 15 programs. And these children are among 14 of over 1,000 that we serve every year. So whereas we are willing to weather the normal ups and downs of whatever's happening in society, and we've been through a lot of changes over the years, I think it's come to a point where this is a time where we refocus and we make sure that we preserve what we have and move forward in a direction that will be supported by the state. But even moreover, not to be so dependent on the state. That's one of the reasons why I'm here, and the reason why I have really pumped up my development staff. We do not intend to allow the state to determine what type of care we provide for children. Maybe in the immediate future, that is a necessity, but we can see this coming and have seen it coming for a long time. And I must say the leadership of the Baby Fold is extraordinarily forward-thinking, and we are looking for new lines of revenue, looking for creative ways to increase our donor base, and so that we can really do the things we know need to be done, like we always have for 115 years.
So if there ever was a time to increase your donations or to give a first-time donation to Baby Fold for the work that it does, now's the time to do it.
That's right. But I just want to make sure that nobody thinks that if they make a donation to the Baby Fold now, we'll change our decision about the discontinuation of that program. We have had some people who have such big and wonderful hearts and want to contact their legislators, and we would like people to turn their advocacy into making those elected officials create a budget that serves the entire state. I mean, our decision for this particular program has already been made, but we would appreciate the pressure for them to take care of their own.
What will you be focusing on now that you don't have the residential program, or will not have mm-hmm. soon the residential program? What will be the programs that will become your primary focus?
I would say for a long time we have been multi-focused. The children that end up at the residential treatment center by far are in the worst conditions. And what we want to do is to try to get ahead of that problem and concentrate on early intervention programs that prevent the problem from ever happening. Because not only is that the right thing to do, and does that have the most positive social impact, but it really also is less expensive financially. I mean, we have a program called Healthy Start, for example, which has a wonderful success rate of actually breaking the cycle of abuse and neglect. And to have a family in that program for about 5 years costs about $5,000. And that is so much less than what it costs at the other end of the spectrum when the problems have just escalated to the point of no return and children end up in residential treatment. We also continue with our foster care program where we recruit and retain foster. I'm sorry, where we recruit and train, rather, foster parents. We've got adoption support services. So if a family has opened their heart to a child that comes from a difficult or challenging background, we go right into their homes and help them straighten out that situation and not bring anybody in, because the goal is to keep children at home with families. So these are the types of things we're doing. Additionally, we're very excited about our Hammett School programming.
Which is?
Well, we've got both a grade school and a junior senior high for special education and also children on the autism spectrum. And these are referrals that come from our public school district. And we just have a wonderful relationship with them. And they count on us when they've taken it as far as they can. We are the place where they turn to reach that child and educate that child. And that really benefits the entire community, because we can create citizens that have a future and that can become all that they're capable of being through us.
Amy Beam, thank you for this update on the Baby Fold. Very important work that you're doing.
Thank you, Judy.
I'm Judy Valente.
The closing of the Baby Fold Residential Center will affect 14 current residents between the ages of 6 and 13. Baby Fold programs serve about 1,000 children and families in the community each year. You're listening to Sound Ideas, and you're listening to Ken Lamb conduct the Charleston Symphony Orchestra performing Mahler's Fifth Symphony. Ken Lamb conducting the Charleston Symphony Orchestra. He's also the new music director for the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, as announced today. He won the position after a year-long search and audition process. Lamb's credentials read as what he was for years, a high-powered international finance attorney born in Hong Kong, Epsom College in Surrey at 15, economics and law at Cambridge, and a career in banking. But after a side job at Naxos Recording Studios, Lamb tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker he returned to music. Lamb says he'd wanted to become a violinist when he was young, but his elders had discouraged him.
My mom said, you know, do something to make a living, as any parent would probably do. You know, you study music and you just treat music as a hobby. So I actually played violin and did a lot of music all the way through my college days, and also when I was a lawyer, I played violin in the London Lawyers Orchestra. And I did that also when I was practicing in Hong Kong. And the conducting came one evening when I was at a rehearsal with a community orchestra, and the conductor didn't show up. His wife's baby was due that evening. So
understandable.
Very understandable. And so the chairman of the orchestra said, well, could somebody do this rehearsal? And I put up my hand and I did it and never really looked back. That was my first conducting experience, and then after a little while, I was still practicing law, but I was conducting quite a lot of, you know, these community groups, and I decided, well, maybe I should learn how to do this properly. So I went online and Googled conducting lessons, and these conducting workshops came up, and they're held in Eastern Europe. So I picked a couple. In the summer, I took my annual leave vacation and went and conducted orchestras and studied with teachers. And one of these teachers was the late Gustav Meyer, who taught at Tanglewood for 20 years. And I studied with him that summer. And at the end, I said, Mr. Meyer, I really want to get better as a conductor. What should I do? And he looked at me and said, well, why don't you come to Peabody? And that was the Peabody
big name.
Conservatory.
When did you realize, or when did he tell you, or both, that you had the ear for it, that you could hear clearly enough to make sense out of the full orchestral sound?
Oh, gosh. I still don't know whether one has it or not, right? Because as with everything, you kind of continue to grow and you continue to get better. I certainly love what I do. And I think, you know, when you have a good job like practicing law, but when you love something so much that it's sort of like it comes back to find you. And when it did, I was glad that I gave up the law. And initially, I really just wanted to do music for a year and see how it goes. I was taking a break from my career. And I thought, well, I take a semester off or I take a year out, I can always go back. So, you know, 10 years later, I'm still doing it. And I, yeah.
Are there parallels in habits of mind among music, law, economics?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are a number of, I think the most important one, I can talk about a lot here, but the most important one is that when you are out there in the commercial world and practicing law and doing business transactions, you deal with an awful lot of people. You deal with some very difficult clients too. You learn to present yourself. You learn to negotiate. You learn to make a case, as the lawyers would do. All of that actually is very applicable to a conductor. Because what is a conductor? Right? Our instrument are 80 human beings. You know, it's not a violin where you can just take it into a room and practice. We have to somehow motivate 80 people, make a case for our vision of the music, and hopefully understand what they feel, just like any manager or leader would do. You know, you're trying to convince them to go with you. And so I think the law really, and also the great thing about law is it puts music not in a vacuum. It puts music in the context of the world we live in. And that's really important to me, too.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Ken Lamb, music director of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra. You mentioned Gustav Meyer. You also studied with David Zinman and Leonard Slatkin. Styles of conducting range from the famous eyebrows only to a fairly dynamic use of arms and the whole body. What's your personality as a conductor?
I think in the best scenarios, I think conducting is not a very good word, because conducting sort of implies you're conducting at something. But what you really want to be is you want to become the music. You want to, if you are conducting a Beethoven symphony, you want it to really represent that symphony so much so that everyone around you will sense that how this is what the music should be, and then they will play accordingly. Now there are of course techniques of conducting. You know, this is a four pattern, this is a three pattern, but I think that to get beyond that, you know, the essence of conducting is really how can you communicate your vision. I mean, I talk about this a lot, but as a conductor, you are the only person on stage who is not actually making a single sound. I mean, you are, so I can't even talk, I can't even tell people what I feel like, but I have to use my face, my hands, and my baton to act it all out and be convincing about it. And so I think raising it, there's a place for raising an eyebrow and doing nothing else. There's a place for being really animated too. It's whatever the music calls for.
Your influences, of course, are varied and international. You've had a lot of experience in choral work and even some opera, some chamber work. Being schooled in Britain, I would expect you to have some fondness for the British pastoralists, and yet you've also programmed some things that have gotten some critical acclaim for your interpretations of Viennese work. So how do you describe your musical personality?
Wow. Well, that's a big one, isn't it? Because if you look at my background, you know, growing up in Hong Kong, which is not really in the Western classical tradition. Well, we do, because Hong Kong was a British colony for many, many years. So we do get raised that way. But there are all sorts of other influences, too. And studying England and now having worked in the States for a long time, I think my answer to your question is this. What is left from composers are the scores. We can study history, we can study what Beethoven's ate for dinner on a particular day, but really what's left is the notes. And whenever we look at the notes and really think what's how a piece should sound like, we can't help but add to that our own imagination and our own history and upbringing to it. So I think what's important is not so much whether I like Beethoven or Mahler or Debussy. I think what's important is that when somebody with my background, with my personality, sees those notes, do I have something to say about them? And I think that's why conducting and it's so interesting, because every conductor brings something different to the table. And I think the notes are the same, but you have different conductors. You have 10 conductors, 10 different interpretations. And I think that's what's amazing about it. And you know, people say, well, you know, you're American, so we can't play Russian music like the Russians. No, actually, I'm not sure I'm too interested to play Tchaikovsky like how Tchaikovsky, people at Tchaikovsky's time would play it. I'm interested in how our musicians and myself, having our collective experiences, how we look at the piece. So that's a very interesting question, I think that's probably what I would say.
Ken Lamb is the new music director for the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, which serves Bloomington Normal and Springfield. He also conducts the Charleston Symphony in South Carolina, and he spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to Lamb direct the Illinois Symphony Orchestra last December in Don Quixote by Georg Philippe Telemann. It's on Sound Ideas.
Summer starts on a high note as CEPQ presents the GLT Summer Concert, featuring Edward David Anderson's Black Dirt Revival. Also on stage, Thornetta Davis and Los Tex-Maniacs. It's the GLT Summer Concert, Saturday, June 10th, in Museum Square in downtown Bloomington. The music starts at 5, and it's free. There's more info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The British are coming, and they're gassed up and ready to go as the David Davis Mansion hosts an annual car show with vehicles from across the pond. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
The 26th annual Champagne British Car Festival is coming up Sunday, June 4th, beginning at 9 a.m. That'll be at the David Davis Mansion in Bloomington. The event showcases a variety of British cars, and this year the festival is spotlighting that 80s phenomenon, the DeLorean, because as organizer Dave Howman describes the car, it's just fun, and it's Irish.
I convinced the committee that Ireland is part of the British Isles.
Certainly.
And under a broad definition, it's British.
So why is the DeLorean so special? I mean, other than the fact that those doors, the way the doors come
doors.
Up. Yeah.
Well, it was an amalgamation of a variety of different cars. Renault had a part in it with the engine. John DeLorean, of course, was the primary mover behind creating them. And as I think everybody knows, he got into a little trouble. Legally, because the company didn't sell as many cars as they had hoped, and so they had some very tough financial situations. And unfortunately, he chose to rectify those financial situations by selling cocaine, which was not a wise move.
And the company went out of business.
They went out of business.
They are not making, unlike Ferraris and Jaguars, they're not making DeLoreans anymore. So if you own one, you own a piece of history.
Correct. They had stainless steel bodies.
They had stainless steel bodies?
So they would never rust. A lot of folks thought that was a very attractive feature.
So that actually does sound pretty cool. Why don't most cars have stainless steel bodies? Is it just too expensive? Okay. And of course, the DeLorean was part of what made Back to the Future so special.
Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine? Out of a DeLorean?
The way I see it, if you're going to build a time machine into a car, why not do it with some style?
Yeah, when that movie came out, DeLoreans became immensely popular. And in fact, I think we're going to have one car that is kind of a replica of the Back to the Future car.
You mean it's tricked out with a flux capacitor?
And the tubes on the outside and everything.
Does he have a license plate that says out of time?
Actually, I think he does.
Oh, that's great.
And he dresses up like Doc.
Christopher Lloyd's character.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's not just DeLoreans at the car festival. What other cars can we expect to see there, Dave?
Oh, Jaguars, MGs, Lotuses, Triumphs. We'll have at least one British motorcycle. Just about any car that was made in Great Britain will be there.
You're also going to give folks who attend the festival a chance to experience what it's like to be in an auction.
Yes, we are very happy that we're going to have Mecum Auctions, what they call the auction experience or mobile experience. And it's a semi-trailer truck that opens up on one side to make a stage. People will be invited to go up on the stage. They'll be given a gavel and pretend like they're auctioning off a car, just like a real auction. And then they'll take a picture of that and email that picture to them. And it should be a lot of fun.
Dave, why hold this at the David Davis Mansion? You know, it's a beautiful house and a gorgeous lawn. They must really like you guys to let you wheel all those cars in there.
Yeah, last year, Jeff Salisbury at the mansion said that we were the best attended single day event that they've had. So that helps when they're going to Springfield and asking for money. It's also a terrific venue. So many car shows are in parking lots. And you got the heat off of the asphalt, you don't have any shade, and it's just not always a pleasant experience. We feel ourselves very, very fortunate to have the trees, the shade, and in addition, the guys that show up have access to the mansion itself, plus the gardens. It works out really, really well.
Well, with all those amazing cars there, Dave, is there an awards ceremony?
Oh, yes. Actually, I'm glad you mentioned that. GLT's Mike McCurdy is going to help us on the award ceremony.
Well, what do you know?
And we'll give out just under 100 awards. There are like 26 or 27 classes, and that will begin around 2:30.
I think it's fascinating. You've got Mike handing out awards for cars when this is a guy who spends his entire life on his bike.
He rides his British bike to the show.
That's Dave Howman from the Champagne British Car Festival, coming up June 4th at 9 a.m. at the David Davis Mansion in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Admission to the car festival is free. At WGLT.org, see a photo of the DeLorean display from last year's Car Fest. The DeLorean had a starring role in the movie Back to the Future. Here's the 1985 Academy Award-winning song from the movie from Huey Lewis and the News. And I'll see you at the festival. Love Huey Lewis and the News on Sound Ideas. And this is Edward David Anderson.
Well, I'm a son of a plumber from a God-fearing mother, and my sisters and my brother are too. Well, I'm a hard-living man, working with my hands, doing what I know how to do.
Son of a plumber from solo artist Edward David Anderson. It's a song you may hear Saturday night at the GLT Summer Concert, when he plays with his full band, Black Dirt Revival. The suburban Chicago native is a longtime member of the Central Illinois music community, but Anderson tells GLT's John Norton that 20 years ago, a music career wasn't where he thought he was headed.
I came here for graduate school in 1995.
What did you study?
Interpersonal communication. I wrote a master's thesis on male friendship. I lived at the Illinois State Lacrosse House for a period of time and was able to use those guys as my pilot study and develop a...
The lacrosse team?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
What did you find out?
Oh, gosh. I mean, we could go on.
Sure, go ahead. This is fascinating.
Anybody that wants to know what my master's thesis was on can go to the Milner Library and look under Edward David Anderson, and they can find out what I wrote about.
What did you want to do with that?
I thought that maybe I wanted to teach college. I thought that maybe I wanted to get a doctorate and go on and maybe teach college. And at the time that I was finishing my thesis, I was in a little band called Brother Jed that got a little record deal from a label, an upstart label in Tempe, Arizona. And we started touring. I finished my thesis in 97 and got in the vehicle that they purchased for us, and I haven't stopped running around.
So Brother Jed was here in Bloomington?
Yeah, that was the first thing for me, yeah.
Was that the precursor to Backyard Tire
Fire? It was, yeah. Eventually, we kind of broke up, and I got married, and when my wife and I moved to North Carolina and lived in Asheville for a couple of years, that's where Tire Fire formed. And then we went to Athens, Georgia, made a record at the Georgia Theater. And then eventually in 2003, we made our way back to Bloomington, and my wife and I bought a house here and have been based out of here, you know, pretty much ever since, aside from these last few winters where we've gone south and
down in Lower Alabama.
Down in Lower Alabama.
Black Dirt Revival.
I'm
looking online all over the place, and I'm like, what is Black Dirt
Revival?
You won't find
anything. You know, I guess it was a couple of months ago, I was invited to play a festival in Terre Haute, Indiana called Blues at the Crossroads. And it was one of those things where they liked what I was doing solo, but they wanted me with a band. And so I kind of put together a band, and we headlined this festival, and it was a huge amount of people. Like, I think that they said 8,000 people attended. So it was one of those things where it just was like a massive humanity, and we had never played a show together. We had one rehearsal together the night before, and we just killed it.
Well, where'd you get the guys?
Well, one of them's a local. I don't know if you know John Ganser. He plays in the Ink Trail.
He was with Something Brothers
Spelunkers, yeah.
Yeah.
John's an absolute monster on drums. I've been a fan of his playing for like two decades. And then there was this young kid that, and he's not young anymore, but I remember when he was a young kid from up in the La Salle, Peru area, Brandon Dyer, kind of kid that just has a bass in his hands. If he's not sleeping, he's playing bass. And I remember him like that when he was young too, and I think he's in his mid to late 30s at this point. But I remember his bands like opening for Brother Jed or Tire Fire back in the day.
Okay.
So I just kind of gave him a shout and to see if he was available. And then my old friend Andrew Weir on keys, who when I released Lies and Wishes, I had a backing band, and he played keys in that band, and he actually did some touring with Tire Fire back in the day. So these guys were available and willing, and I threw a big list of songs at them, and everybody did their homework, and we had a great night. And then I knew that I was going to do one kind of farewell last show at the castle before we left, and I was kind of kicking around different ideas for how to approach it. And after that show went so well in Indiana, I was like, I got to bring these guys out and do the Black Dirt Revival at the castle. And it's really going to be an interesting evening for me. I've always wanted to do a night like this where I open solo. It's kind of the Neil Young thing where you open solo and then bring your band up and rock, which sure. I've never really done before. So I'm very excited about, you know, that kind of a show where I get to play all this stuff solo that I really dig playing, you know, banjo, kick drum, that kind of stuff. And then rock it with the guys afterwards. So I'm going to do an opening set and then bring those guys up.
So the Eminence Front video that's out there, where's that from? Is that
Terre Haute? That was from Lose the Crossroads.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
The skin tracks people forget.
Yeah, that's a killing version too, man. I mean, that was towards the end of the night. It was kind of the pinnacle, and we really had that crowd rocking. And that's when I kind of really made that decision in my head. It's like, I'm bringing these guys to the castle. And the idea of a Black Dirt Revival was, all right, these are a bunch of my boys from the Midwest, for old friends, you know, basically playing, you know, old school stuff. I mean, we are going to do some of my newer stuff and a handful of older Tire Fire tunes, but probably half the set's going to be stuff like Billy Preston and Al Green and
Ooh.
Freddie King
Ooh.
And stuff like that. You
Very
know, it's
cool.
like more like my blues and soul and roots kind of thing. You know, there'll be about half my material and about half of my favorite songs ever.
Okay. Well, let me take you in sort of a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be a big band show at the castle. You came from a band situation, as
mm-hmm.
you talked about, and Backyard Tire Fire is the one I'm more familiar with.
Yeah.
When you transitioned, when Backyard Tire Fire ended, what were you thinking? Were you panicking? Were you going, oh my God, what am I going to do? Or were you going, I know what I want to do?
I think that there was a little bit of what am I going to do now, for sure. Yeah. I was doing every Tuesday with Chicago Farmer over in Pekin, and every Wednesday with Chicago Farmer here in Bloomington.
Well, you guys gave it a good run. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, you're touring nationally.
Right after it kind of, you know, imploded and stopped, Cody and I started playing more shows together, and he definitely got an earful of what am I going to do now? He would be the first person to say, yeah, probably an inebriated earful of what am I going to do now? No, but I think it took me just a little while to kind of figure out like how I could strike out on my own. And to be honest with you, it was people like Cody and my friend Nate Taylor, and there was a guy around here, and he's still around, named Peter Adriel, guys that were playing by themselves where I was like influenced by how they were doing it. I mean, I took little things from each one of those guys and turned it into my solo thing, really. Cody's such a great storyteller, and really his model of how he does it by himself and how he's been able to pull it off by himself, and his wife goes with him a lot and does merch. That was certainly influential on me trying to figure out like how was I gonna, and it was kind of funny because here was Cody was in a high school coming to see me play, and here I was getting like ideas from him all these years later on how to do this by myself. And then my friend Nate Taylor was such a good finger picker and played a lot with his thumb. And when you're playing solo, having your thumb kind of chunking bass and then playing stuff with your fingers, it's an old country blues kind of technique. I hadn't really done much of that. That certainly helped me as a solo artist. And then Peter Adriel working with his feet. He had an interesting like thing where he was playing basically like drum patterns with his feet. And he was using a license plate to get a little bit of a crack for a snare. And I just, you know, I took all that stuff and kind of eventually put it into a solo act, and it just, you know, just kind of really.
So was it an evolution?
Yeah,
or
totally.
Was there a light bulb?
Totally evolution. Total evolution. Okay. Yeah. Eventually, instruments were getting added. The bass drum was added. Then I started playing banjo. I started, you know, basically just kind of, I guess, by trial and error, figuring out what worked and what didn't. And eventually, it turned into this kind of like little solo machine that I have now, where I can make a lot of noise by myself and I have a bunch of different tones and weird, interesting instruments that are handmade by people in Mississippi and stuff. And like, I have a hubcap banjo and a cigar box guitar and a couple cigar box guitars. And all this stuff kind of works into the set that I've put on. And that's the set that I'll be opening with solo at the Castle. It wasn't easy, but I think over the course of a couple of years or a year or so of playing on my own, I was able to figure it out and put a solo record out on Royal Potato Family and started touring. And, you know, here I am, the solo artist.
How many songs will I get to sing? How many nights will I do my thing? How many songs will I get to sing? Babe, before that bell won't ring, I said, how many songs will I get to sing?
Artistically, how are you different than with, say, Backyard Tire Fire?
It's not very much different. No? I wake up and I play music. You know, I write songs, and that's all I've ever really in my adult life is I wake up and I make coffee and I write songs, be it on guitar or piano or whatever. I try to channel what it is that I'm thinking about or how I'm feeling and get my emotions and feelings out through words and music. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've been doing since I was, you know, in my early 20s. So nothing's really changed in that regard. Work ethic, exactly the same. I maybe play a little bit less shows because I don't have to play as many because I do better because I'm just playing by myself.
Oh, okay.
But my work ethic is still off the hook as far as like I can drive a million hours and then play and then drive a million hours and then play. And you know, I'm fairly unaffected by that still. I think I'm pretty similar. I mean, the only thing that's really changed is that, you know, I get to spend more time with my wife. And
well, you guys are sort of doing this together, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, she's doing a lot. You know, she's heavily involved in this whole business and this operation at this point.
Well, let me ask it this way. How important is it to have a spouse, a musician, to have a spouse who understands what you're doing?
Extremely lucky to have someone to try to figure it out with together.
Well, I'm making new friends, and the road never ends. From time zone ago, I've been rolling around with the girl that I found more than 16 years ago. From Athens to Mobile, Lord knows that I feel I'm moving when I'm standing still. I ain't ate a thing, but I'd rather sing and drink till I gotten my fill. I'm one at a time, and ain't no denying, I keep on driving, let's go.
So, but with music, I mean, it always kept me grounded, you know, when I was on the road and she was at home. I always had somebody, some sort of a connection, and her and I were very connected even when we were on different sides of the country. Certainly helped me a lot, keep my sanity out there. Now it's just, we're just lucky. I mean, it's just, and I know that. And I remember like years ago seeing a guy named Keller Williams in an RV with his wife and his dog at like summer camp or something, being like, this guy is so lucky, he just gets to ride around with, and I'm with, you know, with all these dudes in a van, and this guy's with his wife and his dog in an RV riding around, you know, doesn't have to pay anybody else. Well, you know, I it took me a long time, but I finally got there where I'm in my little RV with my wife and my dog, and I, when we do pretty well, and I'm able to go south when it gets cold up here. And I mean, it took a lot of years and some heartache, but we got there, you know, and it's still obviously, like I said, a work in progress. There's so much more to learn and do and grow musically and as a business and as a marriage. You know, it's exciting, the prospects of how much more growth there is to come together.
Well, Edward David Anderson, looking forward to having you back home at the Castle Theater.
Can't wait.
Black Dirt Revival.
Black Dirt Revival will be hitting. I'm going to do a solo set. I think doors are at 7, the show's at 8, and I'm sure Black Dirt Revival will probably hit around 9.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice
Thanks, John.
You. Yeah.
Appreciate you having me, man.
Anderson speaking with GLT's John Norton. Anderson and his full band Black Dirt Revival opened the GLT Summer Concert Saturday, June 10th. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal.